Well, my name is Russell. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group, and I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since January 17th, 1981, and for that I'm very grateful, and I've got my sponsor here. He's got me beat by a few years. What do you got, like 57 years or something? You've been somewhere a long time, that's for sure, but he's a good guy. I met him at a Bible, so I was about 15, 16 years sober, and some guy asked me to asked me whether I would go to a Bible study. I said, what? I said, Bible study? I said, no, Bible study. Go to Bible study, I said. Started thinking about my Aunt Joan and what she'd think, and she'd been dead 20 years or something. Well, I had that alcoholic thinking going on. I was worried about what dead people would think about me, what people in AA would think about me, because at that time, unlike today, everybody in AA was always thinking about me. Apparently, as the program has worked for me over a period of years, I now am at the realization that nobody's thinking about me, you know? And if they are, it doesn't bother me, but that used to bother me a lot, trying to configure my life to your specifications, you know? It's a very hard thing to do, you know? You know, I used to try to, you know, that's what you try to do when you're an alcoholic. You don't want to make waves and you want to be accepted, you know. So I did a lot of acting. Alcoholics do a lot of game playing and acting and fitting in and stuffing and, you know, second guessing and being politically correct and doing all sorts of stuff just so you'll love them. And I did that deal. I spent a lot of money. I said, you know, charging stuff on my credit card that I couldn't afford to buy things I didn't need to impress people I didn't even care about, but did that a lot too. But in any event, so he tapped me on the shoulder and he said, why don't you go to this? So I thought for a second, and after 15 years, apparently, 15 or 16 years, I apparently progressed to the point where after first reacting badly, saying no because I was scared, because it was something new. You know, I'm not an Alcoholics Anonymous for extra credit, although the truth of the matter is it's the extra credit that gets you where you need to go. I mean, if you want to be, you know, experience much of heaven and be rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence, of which we had not even dreamed, it's the extra credit that actually gets you there. So it really depends upon what you want, but you know, listen, I'm talking to you from my experience. I'm just going to share my experience. That's all I'm going to do. And hopefully a little bit about the book and our literature, which is pure AA. But it's like my sponsor used to say to me, you know, Russ, when a man with experience meets a man with money, the man with experience will walk away with the money, and the man with the money will have walked away with an experience. And so I'm just sort of sharing with you. It is my opinion, but it's my opinion based upon what's happened to me in my life over the last 30 years. In working this program or not working this program or fighting this program or trying to get away with doing this program, spending as little time as possible actually sweating and working this program, trying to find the shortcuts so I wouldn't have to do the things I didn't want to do that made me uncomfortable, you know, trying to do it every which way but loose and, you know, saying many, many times, you know, you don't understand, I'm different, and things like that. And so after 30 years of that, and I probably still do that, it's still part of me, but not being defiant, that's what it says our chief characteristic is. Defiance, after many years of having the truth beat into me by life, isn't that how we get a new perspective? That's how I've decided that this game of life, the thing that we're involved in, this probably isn't a dress rehearsal, this may be the real deal. You know, so if you're saying, well, next time I'll do it right, this could be it, you know. And I'm starting to think in the game of life, things seem to work for me better if I do it the way they tell me to do it rather than the way I think it should be done. And I don't know when I came to that conclusion. That's a very, very, that's an incredible conclusion to come to. I think it's like a four-step conclusion, actually. When you come to the conclusion that no matter how strongly you feel about something, no matter how strongly you believe you're right, that even if you feel strongly about something, your sponsor in the big book is probably right and you're probably wrong. And that's a really tough thing to admit. Because I'm an alcoholic, when I think I'm right, I'm right. I mean, that's just the way it is. Even if 50,000 people say I'm wrong, I'm right. And to be able to, that's pretty non-alcoholic thinking when you actually decide, well, you know, I really feel like I'm right, but you want to know something? I'm probably not. So I'm going to follow what my sponsor, the Big Book, has to say anyway. But in order to do that, you'd have to actually know what the Big Book says. So what happens, so when you start, what happened is I started, maybe without even realizing I was doing it, I started conforming my behavior and my attitude to the behavior and attitude which is set forth by in the Big Book. And I don't know how this happened. It probably happened somewhere around the fourth step. Because the fourth step talks about this. It says that fear is the corrosive thread that runs through our lives. From it, all sorts of spiritual maladies come. I mean, fear. And fear is a big deal. You know, a lot of things come from, anger comes from fear. You know, all the other stuff that we think are bad things, worry comes from fear. Fear is a biggie. And so somewhere along the way, I started looking at that fear thing. You know, the spiritual axiom, the spiritual inventory axiom, is whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. You know, and I can tell you, before I adopted, I don't know when the day happened. I can't tell you what happened on this day. I can tell you I haven't had a drink since January 17th, 1981. That's the only thing I can tell you as far as dates are concerned. Everything else is mushy. But I can't tell you the day when I accepted the fact. It probably sort of, you know, that's the way AA sort of works, you know. It's sort of, you connect the dots, but you don't know when you're connecting them. You know, you just wake up one day, and something somebody said in a meeting 3 years ago, and something you read in the book 3 days ago, and something you heard in the meeting just now, all of a sudden sort of connects and it all makes sense. And all of a sudden, one little minute thing makes sense, and you're just that much wiser, like a minnow wiser, you know? And as I started learning these things, and they all went, every one of them, I can tell you this, went counter to my old ideas. I had to get rid of some of the old ideas to allow the good ideas to come in, you know? Bill Wilson talks about emotional sobriety, you know, and he used to say that our real problem is unhealthy dependencies. And, you know, of course, I don't even think, the only dependency I thought I'd have that I admit to was, you know, alcoholism, you know, drinking. But I came to find out that I had a lot of idols, a lot of dependencies, a lot of things I worshipped, a lot of things that, you know, that I was worried about or focused on or scared of losing or spent time on and things like that, that I now know were unhealthy dependencies. I know there were people in my life where I had unhealthy dependencies. My wife, who I love very much, who was diametrically opposed to me in almost every attitude and situation I have, once said to me when I was 6 months sober, you know, they say things like this, I liked you better when you were drinking. Because when I stopped drinking, I started saying things, I would say things like, no. Very bad, you know. She didn't like that. If she didn't like that, I'd say, no. I liked you when you were drinking, you know. When I'd yell at you, and you'd say, oh, okay, yes, you know, because you felt guilty. You know, when you stop drinking, the guilt stops. Well, it catches up with you where the guilt stops, and then you say things like, no. You start getting self-esteem. You say, I don't think I'm going to do that. You know, and I remember walking out the door once, and my wife said, well, what if I told you, you know, if you went to that meeting that I wouldn't be here when you came back? I said, look, I love you very much, and I hope that's not true, but I'm going to the meeting. You know, and, you know, I don't know what that deal was, but I'm probably sober today because I was able to do that, and I was able to do that because I didn't worship her. Because she was not the most important thing to me. You know, I got 4 kids, and I got 6 grandkids, and they're all important, and I love them, and I love my family, but they're not the most important thing to me. I remember hearing some guy in an AA meeting saying, you know, my wife isn't the most important thing, my children are the most important. I said, this guy is crazy, because the world tells you that's the most important thing. He says, the only thing that's important, the most important thing to me is my sobriety. And by saying that, he also linked that up to his faith in God. And I didn't understand that until he added, he said, because without that deal, I wouldn't have any of this stuff. Because when I didn't have that deal going on, my faith in God and my sobriety, I didn't have any of the other stuff. Didn't have any self-esteem or any of that deal. So somewhere along the line, I had And these things sort of sneak up on you. You know, there's these sort of dot connecting things sneak up on you. And somewhere along the line, I had come to realize that fear, like that resentments and fear were not good things. Not good. Bad. You drink over them. You know, I'm going to read some stuff from the book where it says. And so as I said to this guy who tapped me on the shoulder and said, you ought to go to a Bible study, you know, as I recognized that the only reason I liked the guy was a wonderful guy. Hell, I had been reading the Bible because my sponsor had given me the Sermon on the Mount. And as many of you know, in the first 10 years, 15, 20 years of Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the books that was absolutely essential was Matthew 5, 6, and 7, Sermon on the Mount, and the book of James, and 1 Corinthians 13. And so there was nothing un-AA about it. You know, there was nothing that our founders would have had against that. They read it all the time. But the only reason I did it, I recognized that the reason I reacted like that, and I said no immediately. I can always, when I'm working with a new guy, I'm always, it's always interesting to me that they generally say no before I even finish the sentence. That's the way I used to say no. I wouldn't even let you finish the sentence. I'd say no. You know, it was like, no, because that's what fear does. You don't have to finish. It's like, what you really should say is, listen, I'm scared. No. I'm scared. No. I don't want to do that because I'm scared. No. Just don't say no. Say, I'm scared. But I recognized I was scared. And I recognized it was a bad thing to be scared. Now, sometimes I suppose fear is good. I mean, it's probably not a good idea. Probably one of the reasons I don't jump off of tall buildings is because I'm scared of what will happen to me. But most of my fears are things that are going to help me. And I recognize that not doing something, which they talk about in the big book, which has to do with faith, and, you know, after all, we have this 11th step that has to do with, doesn't it say something like, one of the things we're supposed to do in here is trying to improve our conscious contact with God? Well, I don't think you do that by going to the horse races. Or just watching a little more porno on TV, or, you know, I mean, I don't know, going down to the, you know, the Pussycat Lounge or something like that. Or, I mean, I don't know how you do that, but I think those, I go and fish. I mean, it says we're supposed to prove our conscious contact. I mean, in our society, you know what our society looks like. You guys sort of live on the planet, right? In our society, I mean, if AA wasn't around, or AA wasn't the only game in town, because it says we know but a little, what would you do? Where would you hang out? Who would you hang out with to improve your conscious contact with God? Where would you go? You know? What would you do? We watch another Price is Right on TV, or, you know, some more news, you know, or something like that, or read the newspaper? What books would you read? Well, I don't know. I mean, you'd read books like the Bible, like they were reading. That's what you would do. You'd hang out at a church or a synagogue or, you know, someplace where people who believed in God, that's what you would do. If you were serious. But, you know, if you're scared like me, you say no. No. But I recognize that was probably not a good reason to do that deal. So I did something different. I said, okay, and I showed up. And I've been going to that Bible study for the last 15, 16 years. It's every Thursday morning at 7:30 at Old Covenant Presbyterian. And I ultimately joined that church and started working there and started serving there. And that's where I met my current sponsor, John, who came down from Detroit. He's sitting here today, and he's helped me out a lot. I hang out with him a lot, hang out together. And that's just the way I do it. And it's because I said yes instead of no. Just because it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't, you know, I didn't read the big book 15,000 times and memorize the Bible. I just said yes instead of no. And the guy who invited me there, who showed up that one time, never came back again. So I made a whole new group of friends. You know, it said that in the big book. Then I read, you know, then 10 years after I joined, somehow 10 years later, I read that part of the big book that said, we encourage church membership in the family afterwards. You meet a whole new group of friends and people that will fire your imagination, not only AA, but other believers and people who believe in God. And, you know, this will help you. I read that, you know, like 5 or 10 years after the fact, I read in the big book that I was doing precisely what they said I should do, and the way out, what the fruits of sobriety should look like. What it should look like, what a sober person who's trying to grow and trying to conform his behavior and his attitude to his, the attitude and behavior of God and his higher, exactly how that kind of person should look like and what they were encouraging. I was doing it. I wasn't even doing it because they said to do it or because I read in the big, I didn't read in the big book until after that. It's buried in one of those family afterwards chapters, you know, not in the real stuff, like how it works. And that's where I met John and met a lot of other people, and it's been very helpful to me. I'm going to read some things out of Dr. Bob and the good old timers. So here's the deal. You guys heard about the $10 cruise to the Bahamas? You heard that? You know the $10 cruise. How many people haven't heard about the $10 cruise to the Bahamas? Only three? Only three? What is that? What is that not raising the hands? Is that like fear? What is that? What is that? I mean, really, analyze that deal. You know, how can you... I know you guys haven't heard about the $10 cruise to the Bahamas. So what is that deal? What is that? I mean, what is that fear in an AA meeting? Somebody says, have you heard about the $10 cruise to the Bahamas? And you're scared to raise your hand. How can you possibly have a successful life with that kind of fear going on? That's a strange deal. No, really, how are you going to get to 70, 80 years old when you can't even raise your hand in an AA meeting? Because you're scared or embarrassed. That's a pisser, you know? You guys think I'm kidding. I ain't. But in any event, there's all sorts of clues going on. But so the guy's walking along and there's a sign that says, in Miami, there's a sign that says, cruises to the Bahamas, $10. Cruises to the Bahamas, $10. So he walks in and he says, you got a sign up there that says cruises to the Bahamas, $10. He says, yep. $10 for a cruise to the Bahamas. He says, yep. He says, I can get a cruise to the Bahamas for $10. He says, absolutely. He says, there's no catch, $10, that's all. He says, yes, sir. He says, wait a second, you need to tell me for $10, I get a cruise to the Bahamas. He says, absolutely, that's it. No additional money. All I need is $10. He says, we're leaving now. We're leaving right now, you got the $10. You're on the cruise, man. You're on the cruise. I said, you got $10? He says, I got $10. He says, give me $10. You're on the cruise. Guy takes $10 out of the pocket. He hands it to the guy. Next thing that happens, he gets whacked on the side of the head and he goes unconscious. Minutes, hours, days, who knows, later, he wakes up. It's in the late afternoon hours and he's floating in the middle of the Gulf Stream on an inner tube. And the sun is going down in the horizon, somewhere. And he looks, he's floating towards, I guess, floating, where would that be, east towards the Bahamas. I guess that's where the Bahamas are, east. And there's no land in sight. And he knows it's about 100 yards up, a figure of another guy in an inner tube. So he starts paddling over to the other guy who's in the inner tube. And he finally gets there, and the other guy in the inner tube is there with a, you know, baseball cap on. And the guy says, do you believe this? He says, 1 minute I'm standing there. I'm sitting, you know, with this guy talking about a $10 cruise to the Bahamas. And the next minute I give him $10 and I'm whacked up the side of the head. And now we're in the middle of the Gulf Stream here. I mean, there's no land in sight. We're going to die out here. What's going on? I can't believe this. The guy with the baseball cap says, hey, tell me about it. He said, this is unbelievable. This is criminal. How could somebody do this? I can't believe this is happening. This is the worst experience I've ever had in my life. The guy with the baseball cap says, tell me about it. You're telling me? Tell me about it. He says, I don't know. This is amazing. So he just sits there and they're just sort of floating together. And I guess eventually they're going to get there. And finally, the guy turns to the guy with the baseball cap and, you know, just sort of says this. You think they feed us on this cruise? And The guy with the baseball cap says, I don't know, they didn't last year. That's funny. It's funny because you know why it's funny? Here's why it's funny. I don't know why it's funny. You know, it's stupid to analyze a joke. You know why I think it's funny? It's funny because it's so stupid, right? Like, the guy in the baseball cap is so stupid. Stupid. And he's stupid because he did something stupid, like, over and over again. So it's like, it's so stupid that he did the same thing over and over again that you got to laugh at it, right? Yeah, so welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to the land of unbelievable stupidity. Alcoholics, let me tell you what the primary... Yes, the chief characteristic is defiant, and we're stupid. I got a fairly decent IQ. I was going for my PhD in algebraic topology. Had aced all the courses at the University of Miami, multivariable calculus, calculus on manifolds, the whole bit. Graduated law school. You know, I'm not no dummy. I was stupid. Having brains and being smart doesn't mean you're not stupid. I wound up with all that intelligence, I wound up at 31 years old, broke, alone, having ripped the heart out of a nice gal, having abandoned a son, a young son, having lost my house, having lost everything, having lost my self-esteem and my self-respect because I was stupid. Now, I'd like to be able to say I was in an alcoholic coma for like 10 years, and I just sort of woke up. But the truth is, most of the time, I was as sober as I am right now. And most of the people I hurt in my life and the stupid things I did in my life, I did cold stone sober. Not emotionally or mentally sober, but physically sober. I'd love to be able to say alcohol, blame alcohol for everything I did every time I hurt somebody. You know, but the truth is, I take full responsibility for the things I did. Not my mother, my father, anybody else to blame. I did it. It was done on my best thinking, on my best days. And the only thing alcohol ever did for me is allow me to live with my sorry ass self while I was hurting people and ruining my life and telling myself the lies that I was really doing okay. And I've hurt many of the same people, many of the same ways, doing many of the things that I did before after coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. What do you think about that? And even today, when I screw up, which I do from time to time, it's usually the same way with the same thing, with my mouth, or doing something stupid, okay? Because, you know, I think I'm right or something like that, because alcoholism still lives alive and well in me. Because I am the guy in the baseball cap saying they didn't last year. I am that guy. I am that guy. So how do you get rid of that deal? That's an interesting thing. How do you get rid of that deal? I mean, does that you get rid of that deal by stopping drinking? I don't think so. You know, I had to come in here. I'll tell you how bad it was for me. They had to assign me a used car salesman as a sponsor just to dummy me up a little bit. Why is it when you come in here, if you submit yourself to a sponsor, they're always... Even though they haven't even graduated second grade, they're always so much more. They're always so much smarter than you are. The guys I hung around with, I mean, I intellectually, as far as grade and education, I had a lot more going for me, you know. But they always would say things. They where do they get this stuff? Where do they get? Where is there like some sort of sponsor school they go to, where you could tell your wife, the principal of the school, the judge, all these lies? All this bullshit, and they believe it, and they look at you, and they buy it, and you tell this used car salesman something, and with like two words, he like cuts your legs out from underneath. Where do they get this stuff? I show him all the degrees on my wall, and explain to him, and he says, you know, Russ, rectal thermometers have degrees, and you know what they do with those. Where do you get stuff like that? I don't think I have to go to meetings on Thursdays. Well, sure, as long as you never drank on Thursdays. You know, where do they get this? Where do they come up with this stuff? It's like a sponsor school they go to. where they manage to say something that not only has truth in it, but they say it in such a way, at least for a guy like me, that it sort of like hits you in the stomach at the same time. You know, where it puts your stupidity right in front. You know, how do you get an alcoholic who thinks he's smarter than anybody, will wreck a relationship? This marriage is over! Wreck a relationship, hurt people. How do you get them like that to all of a sudden like put a mirror in front of them and say, I am stupid? But what would you pay? How much money could you pay where every time you had an insane thought, an insane idea, something that was gonna lead you down the road to losing a job, losing a wife, losing a husband, losing your self-esteem? How much would you pay for before you went down that road to be able for a nanosecond to have a mirror put in front of you where you could say, boy, that was stupid. I'm stupid. That was stupid. What was I thinking? You know what I mean? Usually we say things like, what was I thinking? You know, right after the jail cell door clangs, you know what I mean? Boy, that was stupid. I mean, what would you pay to have like that mirror in front of you where before you even got to the jail cell, before you even got to the arrest, before you even got into the situation, before you even did anything, all of a sudden you said, boy, that's a stupid idea, I'm not going to do it. I mean, there wouldn't be like enough money in the world to be able to have restraint of thinking. So that, you know, to have that deal, I mean, to have like an iPod or some sort of computer on you, where every time you had a stupid thought or compulsion or desire, I think I'll go right or I think I'll go left, something that could be in front of you, which not only was acted in such a way so that you didn't do it, but you didn't. It's not that you didn't do it because you were being forced not to, where you could actually see that it was stupid, where you had like something called common sense, where you could see that it was stupid and not act upon it and feel good about it. I'll bet if that kind of stuff happened, I bet your life would go, what do you think? I think your life would go a lot smoother. What do you think? I think it would go a lot smoother. My sponsor used to say things to me like, your best thinking got you in here, Russ. Your best thinking on your best day got you in here. I've sponsored a lot of people. I've sponsored a lot of men, and which is an interesting experience. I spoke to a lot of alcoholics. Got a lot of people calling me up asking my opinion, and I can't tell you how many times people have called me up. Just had one the other day. You know, I watch them. They call me up and they ask me my opinion, and I tell them my opinion, and then before I'm halfway through, they say, "No, you're wrong." And you know, I learned a long time ago, when you have to explain the explanation, you might as well stop right there. It's almost a sign of insanity if you keep on talking after that. I used to go up to my sponsor and I'd say things like, what do you do when they won't listen to you, when they won't follow your directions? He says, I tell them to do just whatever the heck they want to do because they're going to do that anyway. And so they go ahead and do what they want to do, and then you don't hear from them for 6 months, and they call you up again, and they're in another jam, or this time the wife left them, and you tell them once again that, you know, in your own inevitable way, how what you think they should do, or whatever it is, and once again they tell you, no, you're wrong, you don't understand, yes, but, if only, it's not my fault, and then you don't hear from them for another 6 months, and then they call you up and they've lost their job. Now it's the wife, and then it's the job, and they say, what do you think? And I say, well, I think the same thing I thought 6 months ago and 6 months before that. You know, you need to do this, and you need to do that, and you're not willing to do this, you're not willing to do that. And you say, no, I don't see it that way. I don't see it that way. I think you're wrong. You don't understand. You've got to listen to me. You know, and then you say, and so once again, they say you're wrong, you don't hear for another 6 months, and they call you up, and they say things like, you still do DUIs? They just got out of jail, you know what I mean? They just want to tell you, and you can watch it happen. You know how many times I've watched that happen? A guy who's up here, go down here and lose everything over a period of 5 or 6 years because he just will not listen because he's too smart. You know how many times I've seen that happen? It's just incredible to watch it happen. It doesn't happen like that. It doesn't happen. You'd like it to happen like that. You'd like a guy to say, What are you stupid? I'm not going to do that. You don't understand. Then all of a sudden, lightning strikes his whole life. You know, you'd like it to happen sort of like, I always think that the movie The Christmas Carol, remember the movie The Christmas Carol? Is a perfect example of what really should happen to alcoholics. It really is sort of like an alcoholic movie when you think about it. When at night, the ghost of Christmas past, he says, this is the way it was, this is the way you acted, this is where you're winding up in death. And then remember what Bob Cratchit said? He says, is this the way things have to be, or can they be changed? And then he wakes up and he's old. Well, really, that's really what happens with alcoholics. They just see their death in front of them, and they sort of get it, and they say, can I change this deal? And they wake up, and it's a whole new deal. But some guys never wake up. Some guys just aren't visited by the ghosts. You know, the ghosts don't come, or they miss them, or something like that. And that's the deal. And so somewhere along the way, in learning about this deal, and, you know, we have this fourth step. I did it. I guess you do it one time. I think you do it one time. Now, don't get me wrong. You take inventory a gazillion times. You take written inventory a gazillion times. But the bottom line is you do only one fourth step. You understand? Because everything after that is like continuation of it. Now, it can be the crummy. This is my opinion, but I think it's logical. I think it's biblical based on. Now, it could be the worst fourth. I did the worst fourth step. I probably did the worst fourth step that's ever been done in history, but it was the best one I could do that night. I put it off for 18 months, for 19 months. I'd go to meetings and I'd say, I was slowly deteriorating. I remember I went up to my sponsor. Once again, I went up to the used car salesman. I said, this thing ain't working for me. It's dangerous to share your thoughts and feelings with guys like this. That I'd say, it ain't working for me. He said, what's not working? He says, well, I'm doing everything. This is what I said. This is how crazy we are. I said this cold stone sober, 18 months sober, cold stone sober. I look at him. This is how crazy an alcoholic is. This is alcoholic craziness. I look at him and I say, it's not working for me. Why was it working? Because I wasn't feeling good. And isn't feelings the most important thing in the world? No. But, you know, to an alcoholic, they are. That's what it's all about. It's all about my feelings. It's not about whether you're dying of cancer. It's not about whether or not I'm meeting my financial responsibility. It's not about whether I'm taking care of my family. It's not about whether I'm a man of honor. It's about whether I feel good. You know? And now I realize that feelings are the least important things. Sometimes when you're feeling great, you're doing horribly. Sometimes when you're feeling horrible, you're doing great. As a matter of fact, one of the greatest times of my life was when I was doing worse than I had ever done in my life, circumstantially. And I was going to the hospital, I was going to detox, and I was fulfilling responsibilities and doing meetings, even though I had every reason in the world to stay home and feel sorry for myself. But I just was doing what I was supposed to do. And one day it dawned upon me, and I was saying to myself, man, when is this thing going to work? When is this thing going to work? And all of a sudden it occurred to me. God allowed me to have that mirror. He said, you know, Russ, you don't have any money in the bank. You don't know where the money's coming from. You got to support a wife and four kids. You know what I mean? And nothing's going right for you now, and you're out here at 10 o'clock at night trying to help another alcoholic. And you're not drinking. You're doing great. And I was allowed to see that. And it was probably a time in my life where I felt the best about myself, you know, at that time. So sometimes when you're feeling lousy, and you're doing lousy, you're doing great. And sometimes when you're doing lousy, you aren't doing lousy. And sometimes when you're doing great, you are doing great. So, you know, I don't really judge myself by my feelings. That's from my sponsor. I let my sponsor tell me about that deal. He'll let me know whether I'm doing great or not. So in any event, I said to this sponsor of mine, I said, this thing ain't working for me. This AA thing. He says, it's not working. He says, no, I'm doing everything. I'm doing everything. You know, I've been going to meetings or doing stuff. I don't know what I was doing. He says, I'm doing everything and it's not working. And he said, the used car salesman, he said, well, maybe, Russell, you're one of the rare ones. I said, what? What? I was like 32, 33 years old, trial attorney, former division chief of the state attorney's office, you know. He says, what? He says, well, maybe you're one of the rare ones. He says, one of the rare ones? He says, yeah, maybe you're one of the rare ones. I said, the railroads, what's that? He says, well, they talk about it every meeting. I said, well, he says, well, they talk about it every, you've been going to meetings, right? I said, well, yeah, they talk about it every, I never heard them talk about it. He says, you never heard them talk about the rare ones? He says, no. He says, they talk about it every meeting. He says, you, I think, are one of the rare ones. He says, which I said, well, that must be it. You know, I've always told you I was different. I told you I was unique. I'm the rare one. He says, yeah, he says, the rare one. He says, don't they say it means? He says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. You have done everything. Isn't that what you said? You said, I'm doing everything, and it's not working for me. You must be one of the rare ones. You've done everything in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's not working for you. AA is obviously something that isn't going to work for you. You should probably leave and find something else. And I thought, and of course I thought he was serious, I wanted to blow my brains out, because the only thing that had ever worked for me was Alcoholics Anonymous. And now my sponsor was telling me I had to leave because AA wasn't working for me. Well, of course, that's what I told him. It wasn't working for me. And I sat there. I had nothing, if you could believe this, I had nothing to say. I was like sitting there like, I want to blow my brains out. He says, no, stupid. He talked to me like that because he loved me. He said, no, stupid. He says, you don't have to leave AA, but don't tell me you're doing everything in AA. Have you done your four step? I said, well, no, you know. I'm working on it. You know, it's alcohol code for I ain't never going to do this thing. Because why should I have to do a four step? I know what's wrong with me. I've got it all up here in my brain, you know. It's all my, I'm thinking about it. I'm figuring it out. He said, I finally went to a meeting, and so I kept on putting it off. And, you know, when you put off, when you stop working the program of recovery, you stop recovering. And by stopping recovering, sometimes the fruits or the symptoms of not recovering from alcoholism is not necessarily drinking. Sometimes it has to do with a change of attitude. Self-pity or anger or resentment, it has to do with the way you feel about yourself. And it starts, and you know, sometimes it is about drinking. That's the dangerous thing. It doesn't always throw up a white flag and say, I'm here to grab you. Sometimes the first time you realize that you have a drink, you're slipping, is after you've taken the first drink. But for me, I just started decompensating emotionally, spiritually. And then finally I went to a meeting, you know, the eighth time. I went to the meeting whining about how it's not working for me and I haven't done my four step and I don't know, I need to do it. And some guy said, why don't you just go home and pick up a pencil, start writing. All of a sudden that clicked. I mean, I had gone to all sorts of meetings to learn how to do the four step and what to do the four step. And nobody had ever told me to pick up a pencil. Went home and I picked up a pencil and I whipped off a four step in 2 hours. I know there are guys that take 16 months and write the American. I did 2 hours. There were like 20. I started writing resentments. There were like 20. You know, I'm gonna, you know, when you first come in, I don't dislike anybody. I don't have any resentments. You know, there's like 30 people on the list. You know, some of my best friends were on the list. You know, because they liked them better than they liked me because he's got more money. There were people on the list. My first cousin was on the list. Everybody was on the list. It was unbelievable. I had that list down, and then I did it out of the book. I followed the book. Hey, listen, you can do Hazelton. You can do whatever you want to do. All I know is I did it from the big book. Hey, here's the way I forget. We have a basic text. This is the basic text. It's the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not against you do it any way you want to do it, okay? And I'm not telling you if you did it a different way, you were wrong. I'm just telling you we have a basic text called the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. For God's sakes, they have a chart. It's four lists. Four lists. List of resentments, you know, list of fears, faults, you know, sexual faults and things where we've hurt people, you know, in the sex situation. And there's four lists and it tells you exactly how to do it. I'm saying, hey, if you're going to do this thing, why don't you at least try the big book? And of course, since that's the way I do it, that's the way I tell other people to do it. You know, because I'm used to thinking of things that way and dealing with things that way. And you want to know something? It's so unlike the way I actually think. It's like my brain is wired differently. But, you know, if you do this over and over and over again, you write this down over and over again, your brain, my brain starts thinking in fourth step language. You know, I'd write these resentments down of all these people I couldn't stand. You know, by the way, one of the things, if we were to live, this is what they talk about, if we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. The grouch, my whole life was either being pissed off or having, I've got an idea. Hey, My whole life was brainstorm or grouch. And it says the grouch and the brainstorm is not for us. Well, what am I going to talk about? The grouch, they may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for the alcoholic, these things are poison. Alcoholism is poison. Selfishness, self-centeredness, we have to get rid of this. We must or it kills us. How do we do that? And it goes on. This is all part of the fourth step. It says we reviewed our fears. It talks about fears. All the fears I had that I didn't even know I had. Thoroughly. We put them on paper. Even it's hard to experience much of heaven and be rocking in the fourth dimension of existence, of which you have not even dreamed, when you're scared shitless. When you're worried. When you realize that, as they say in the 12 and 12, what do they say here? Maybe I'll actually have turned it to the most common symptoms of emotional insecurity are worry, anger, self-pity, and depression. The most common symptoms of emotional insecurity are worry, anger, self-pity, it's feeling sorry for yourself. Well, in your case, it's just thinking about yourself. If you don't know what feeling sorry for yourself is, it's like when you think about yourself. Don't worry about it. A few years, this will make sense to you. The most common, trust me, if you're thinking about yourself, you're feeling sorry for yourself. Trust me. If you're thinking about yourself, you're feeling sorry about yourself. The most common symptoms of emotional, and if that's not true, I apologize. Whatever. The most common symptoms of emotional insecurity are worry, anger, self-pity, and depression. I'm not even asking how many people experience that stuff, you know, because you're not going to raise your hand anyway. But don't you want to get rid of that stuff? Would you like to? What would life be if you weren't worried about anything? I mean, I'm not saying that necessarily happens perfectly, or you never. I'm not saying, you know, I never worry about anything. But you want to know something? Compared to, you know, there's a big difference between worrying all the time about everything, nonstop, and worrying once a week for like a minute. There's a big difference between those two. You know, what would your life be like if you didn't get angry? What would your life be like if you weren't worried about stuff? Worried about money. If you didn't worry about money. Not that you had money. You didn't have, you still didn't have, you're in the same financial position you're in. You just don't worry about it. You had health problems, you had cancer, stuff, you just didn't worry about it. Self-pity and depression, well, you didn't feel sorry. What would your life be like if stuff happened to you, happened around you, happened to you, that was not good, that was bad, and ready for this, and it didn't bother you? What would that be like if stuff, I'm not saying if good, I know what you're saying. Here's what you're thinking. Here's, you're like me, he says, listen, I don't have a drinking problem. I drink because I have problems. You know, as a matter of fact, my drinking perfectly matches my problems. If I didn't have any problems, I wouldn't drink. And pretty soon my problems are going to go away and I don't going to drink anymore, so thank you very much for your advice, but why don't you go screw yourself? You know what I mean? I understand it's all about the problems. You know, if problems would go away, if you had $1 million, everything, but how would you like, but it's not going to work that way. You know, it hasn't worked like that for 30, 40, 50 years you've been on the planet, right? You know, so we're going to have to figure out a different way. So how about this way? Your problems don't go away, but they don't bother you. How about that? Would that be okay? You know, that's part, you know, this is about, when we talk about staying sober, I know you guys think staying sober is about not drinking, right? That's what you think. You think sobriety, because they give out the medallions for that. That's what they give out the medallions. He hasn't had a drink in 30 years yet, so you think it's about not drinking. I mean, it is about not drinking. I'm not putting down not drinking. It's like real important not to drink, okay? But I'm gonna tell you something. The longer you hang around here, you're going to run into people that have gotten more. You're going to run into people that have gotten that left the not drinking thing in the dust. And I'm not saying this because I'm putting you down or saying, hey, look at me. I'm saying that you're going to meet people that went further down the, you know, when they say we've been rocking in the fourth dimension of existence, which, you know, they're not talking about not drinking. when they say see to it that your relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass for you and countless others, they're not talking about not drinking. When they say make this decision, all sorts of remarkable things will happen. They're not talking, when they say no matter, you're going to know a new freedom and new happiness, they're not talking about not drinking. When they say no matter how far down the road you know, see where it'll benefit others, fear of people and of economic insecurity will disappear, they're not talking about not drinking. They're talking about that not worrying, not being afraid. Living your life the way you want to live your life, being you, feeling free. They're talking about being transparent. They're talking about like a dream life, which has nothing to do with whether you have a new car or old car. That doesn't even touch you. That's what they're talking about. And being able to see things and do things and operate properly without making a lot of mistakes. And that's what it's about. And I had to end up doing this thing, right? I'm going to end this by just saying, you know, they have this, one of the things that happens in the fourth step, which really, with my sponsors, I think my sponsors were working on me, my sponsor worked on me in a fourth step sort of scenario, brainwashing me, even before the fourth step got a hold of me. You know, in the fourth step, it has things like, after you do the list of resentments, all the people you hate because of what they did to you, because if you're an alcoholic, you're a blamer. You're a blamer. You figure out how to have bad feelings about everybody and everything. Trust me. You know, you'll figure out, even after a good meeting, how to walk out the door and find something wrong with it. You know what I mean? You'll find something wrong with anybody, okay, and anything. What does it say after resentments? You know, the next step after resentments is we disregard what they did to us entirely. Have you ever done that? Where were we to blame? Do you think alcoholics think that way naturally? Disregarding everything they did. We forget about it. Where were we to blame? What did we do wrong in this situation? That's hard. It's not only hard disregarding, it's almost impossible thinking of where I was ever wrong. Do you know when you get used to doing that kind of stuff, it's really hard to hold the resentment. When you start thinking that way, my sponsor started me thinking weird, started thinking me sober, way before I did the fourth step. When I used to call them up on the phone and they started me with this A way of thinking and I'd say I have a flat tire. You know, I have a flat tire. He says, man, sounds like a good problem to me. What do you mean a good problem? He says, well, some people don't have cars. My boss is an ass. My boss, I hate my boss. I hate him. You know, I says, you have a job? Whoa. You know, I can't believe it. My plumbing went out of my house. You have a house? Wow, that's a good problem. Some people don't have houses, you know? I'd have, every time I come up with something, which was natural, you know, some, all I'm doing is I'm vomiting how I feel and how I think. And, you know, I don't think I'm unique in this deal. I don't think I'm unique in this group. You know? How many times have you picked up the phone today or spoken to somebody today about your problems? You know, have any of you guys picked up the phone today or run into somebody and say, you wouldn't believe what just happened to me? You ever said, you wouldn't believe what happened to me? Have you done it more than once? Have you done it with a bunch of people? Have you done talk? Did you talk to other people about it? Cut that shit out. You can't. You're addicted to it, can you? You think I'm crazy, right? I don't understand, right? You see, if I smile, you'd say, no, you don't understand. And you try to tell me about it, right? I'd say, I want to hear it. And you think I'm crazy. Because you think by talking about it makes you feel good. And all it's doing is making you feel crappy. But you don't realize that it's not necessarily helping. You don't really, because you've been doing it all your life. It's to an alcoholic, that's the most natural way of thinking. The alcoholic thought is his natural way of thinking. You know, what comes out of your mouth, you believe it. If you start talking crap out of your mouth and gossip about people and say bad crap out of your mouth, it comes back and it sits in. It doesn't go away. It comes back and brings a few friends. But to me, it's natural to do that, to just bitch and moan and find more people to share with bad stuff. How do you learn about that unless you start doing steps like this and find people that are willing to sit down with you, give you a little spanking and tell you, no, we don't talk like that. We don't think like that. I mean, you have a God-given right to complain, right? Sure, you can feel as bad as you want to feel. You can feel as bad as, you know, these are things I had to learn and learn and relearn and relearn and relearn over again through the fourth step and the fifth step until it just became almost a natural way of living. And even now I could slip back just like that. I could slip back just like that. So thank you very much. Next week we'll talk about steps. Okay, I guess there are no dues or fees. The baskets have gone around.